February is Black History Month in the United States, a time in which the whole nation together remembers the trials that Americans of African descent have faced and celebrates their achievements. The story of the first black fighter pilots to see combat is one of the great chapters in U.S. history. The Tuskegee Airmen, as they were known after their training base that was part of the Tuskegee Institute, the storied university, founded as a technical college by the visionary American educator Booker T. Washington, who was himself born a slave and who became one of the great social and political figures of the late 19th and 20th centuries, served with distinction in North Africa and Italy during World War II. On the invitation of the U.S. State Department, a veteran of the unit, Dr. Eugene Richardson Jr., visited Rome this month to give a series of talks about the contribution the airmen made, not only to the cause of victory in war, but to the cause of civil rights and racial justice at home. He told Chris Altieri his story.
Well, the State Department has an American corner in a number of places, and I come to Rome to talk to people about America and about civil rights in America and the progress we've made, and Tuskegee Airmen, our part in the civil rights movement, and so forth.
Now, the Airmen was a storied unit.
Yes.
I noticed that you got your wings only in March 45.
Yes, close to the, well, at the end of the war.
Yeah, right, mm-hmm. Very near the end. But why don't you tell us a little bit about your service, starting out with from the beginning? Why don't we begin at the beginning?
Well, I guess the beginning was the beginning of flight school. I went down to the Customs House in Philadelphia and took a test. I passed the test that qualified me to go into flight training. Other than that, I would have been drafted and put in the infantry somewhere to dig foxholes and march around in mud and that kind of stuff. And I thought flying would be much more compatible with my dreams and so forth. And Tuskegee, Alabama, the institute there is the only place in the country where black men could go for flight training for the Army Air Corps. And but there was an airfield about 6 miles from the campus. Now, the institute owned that one particular airfield, but the government built an Army airfield about maybe 10 miles in the other direction, a full-size Army airfield with 8 runway directions, eight or 10 runway directions. And Tuskegee Institute got a contract with the Army to be the place where black men would be trained for the Army Air Corps.
And the military was still completely segregated at this point in our history.
Yes, totally segregated. This is 1940. They got the contract in 1941. It is totally segregated. Yes, true. We actually had to sue the Army to get a chance to be pilots. You see, all this goes back to a lot of junk in 1925, where the United States Army War College, I emphasize college because these are the upper levels of the military officers that go to the Army College, and they issued a report that had every negative you can imagine that you would attach to a person in that report describing the black man. Now, they knew it was a lie. They knew how blacks performed in the Revolutionary War, 1812, Civil War, World War. They knew all of that.
In fact, that's an interesting point and well worth mentioning, because people who have seen the picture with Matthew Broderick and Denzel Washington and the glory.
Oh, the glory, but, glory.
And it's great, and it's a magnificent story.
Yes.
But that was not the first time that we had a black serviceman performing with distinction in our armed forces. Historically, that's not the story.
No,
is
it isn't. Historically, blacks served very well in the Revolutionary War. One out of every 7 soldiers in George Washington's army was a black man. And they served in a number of the battles the decisive battles of the Revolutionary War. So the Army War College knows how black men performed. And even after the Civil War, the Buffalo Soldiers, how well they performed. during World War One.
That's it. In 1925, so this is 7 years on from the end of World War One.
Yes.
There had been black soldiers and black units that performed with great distinction in the First World War in Europe. So,
but yet they write this report. It was solely for the purpose of marginalizing the black man. That was the whole purpose of it, because they knew what they were writing was not true. Now, one of the vestiges of slavery, we want to keep the black man as subservient in a subservient position. So they don't want the black man to do anything to make him think he's equal to or as good as a white man. So they put this stuff out so that the army will have a reason, a rationale for keeping black men, to keep them subjugated. That's the only reason I can see for the report, because everything in it is just an out-and-out lie, just total nonsense. But yet, this is what the army was using to evaluate black men for military service.
But when you went into this, you were going in with your eyes open then. I mean, you had no illusions about what you were going into.
Yes, because... Both my parents are from the South. Both of them are from Alabama. But then there's the black press, the Pittsburgh Courier, Chicago Defender, Philadelphia Tribune. There's any number of black newspapers that carried a great deal of information about the Army and how the Army was functioning and so forth. And they were also the source of a lot of civil rights militancy. So I knew that the Army was segregated, and I knew how segregation worked, because even in Ohio, there were little pockets of things that went on. Like they would let you in this one particular restaurant, but they had to break up the plates after you finished eating. My sister had a very light-skinned girlfriend. Now, there are two sisters. One is real fair, and one is medium complexion. My sister is about my complexion. They'd go for a walk on Sunday, stop to buy ice cream. They would serve the light-skinned black, but they wouldn't serve my sister and this girl's sister. So that's how idiotic it was.
Yeah, this is it's not the country that I grew up in,
mm-hmm.
And yet it's in the living memory of people.
There's
still,
so many people. Yes.
So why don't you talk with us about the airman as a catalyst of change? Mm-hmm. Did that happen? Were you aware of this? Were you aware that you were doing something of this historical importance?
We knew it was important because we knew that the entire black race would be judged by the performance of black men in the aviation units. Because as far as the Army was concerned, this was an experiment to prove that report is true and that black men do not have the characteristics and qualities of the pilots.
But now we can assume that this was a success, because the Army is not known for being a crucible of social experimentation.
Mm-hmm,
but, you know, within the time of Korea, between the end of the war and the start of the Korean War, we have integration, right? And
mm-hmm.
And so, well, walk us through this. Is that I can't imagine that as deeply ingrained a system, a social system that the Army is,
mm-hmm.
Would overnight become this paradise of racial justice.
It didn't happen overnight, believe me. The performance of black men during the time of World War II, especially black pilots, we wound up with 992 black men finishing the advanced flying school, becoming Army pilots. 400, close to 400 of them, served in combat in North Africa and here in Italy. And Harry Truman, the President Truman, recognized how well black men were performing. There was also the 761st Tank Battalion, an all-black tank battalion that served under Patton. He had the 92nd Infantry here in Italy. He had the Nisi's, he had the Cold Talkers. And President Truman saw how well these people performed, and he felt it was just a waste of manpower. Just nonsense, number one, but a waste of manpower to have these segregated units. So in 1948, President Truman issued Executive Order 9981, which in effect started the end to segregation in the military. And with the issuance of that order, black units were disbanded and scattered. And a couple of Tuskegee Airmen became generals. Our commanding officer, the top general at that time, was Daniel Chappie James, who became a four-star general, and he commanded the entire North American Air Defense System. He was the commander of NORAD, and also including a communications unit that this black man commanded. Now, our commander, the pilot's commander, Benjamin Davis Jr., he retired as a three-star general, but President Clinton awarded him his fourth star, knowing that he should have had four stars while he was on active duty. A couple other generals, a black two-star, Theus, he became head of the Air Force's finance unit. Out of the desegregation, in fairly short order, we got like four black generals, where this Army report is saying that you cannot expect to draw leadership material from this race. Just an interesting thing about Daniel James. We had an air base in Libya, Wheelis Air Force Base in Libya. At the time that Gaddafi overthrew King Idris, I think it was, about the time that Gaddafi overthrew him, Daniel Chappie James was a lieutenant colonel at Wheelis Air Force Base in Libya. And Gaddafi tried to take over the air base. And Daniel James met him with a .45 and said, not here. So Gaddafi backed that, but we eventually closed Wheelis Air Force Base. But he was involved in that also. Now, after Truman, the military is desegregated. In 2007, we received the Congressional Gold Medal from Congress, and President Bush presented it. We were in the rotunda, a little over 300 of us in the rotunda, and it was President Bush, Nancy Pelosi, Senator Rangel, Senator Levin, General Colin Powell. A lot of dignitaries were there when President Bush presented the Congressional Gold Medal. It's in the Smithsonian.
And this was given to all the surviving airmen?
Tuskegee Airmen, yes. Some philanthropists got a whole stack of them and gave each of us a bronze, I guess it's bronze or brass or whatever, I don't know, a bronze copy of things like so. But you can get miniatures, those that you can carry around and wear. And on the back of this thing it says, Outstanding Combat Performance Inspired Revolutionary Reform in the Armed Forces. That refers to the fact that the performance of Tuskegee Airmen inspired President Truman to issue the executive order, which brought about great change in the military.
And it is a place now that is a very, very powerful meritocracy and practicing
right,
what it
yes,
preaches.
Uh-huh.
The culture is completely different from mm-hmm. what it would have been in 45. Can you identify for us some of the watershed moments in this where mm-hmm. you could say, okay, now we can see that real progress has been made? And you point to, in the Air Force, the generals, I'm thinking also
right.
in the other service branches, especially in the early years of our involvement in Vietnam. This mm-hmm. was also a time that General Powell, the Secretary of State Powell, was having his combat.
Right, in Vietnam. One of the things was probably – during the time of Vietnam, it was fairly well mixed up. For the Korean War, even, there were black units that were integrated in service areas. I don't know how well the units themselves were integrated, but at least they went out and, worked there. The 54th Infantry was the 54th Infantry was still in existence for the Korean War. Well, that was, an all-black unit. But at least there was more cooperation between the races. There were black pilots in the Korean War. Some of the Tuskegee Airmen served in the Korean War. As a matter of fact, there are three of our guys served in three wars, World War II, Korea, and Vietnam.
Well, in Korea, then, so they've gone through the institutional separation of the Army Air Corps and the creation of the Air Force as a
mm-hmm.
separate service branch.
Right.
They've been through the integration at this point, and we're, 7 years on from the end of World War II. So these are people who pursued a career in the military.
Right.
Mm-hmm. These are career officers, we'd say.
Yes.
So that was always a possibility. Was it something that you considered at any time?
No. When I was discharged in 1946. I used the GI Bill to continue my education. A lot of the fellows, I got into the Air Corps by passing a qualifying test. A lot of the guys had a year or so of college. And I met with these guys, and I'm a couple years below them so far as education was concerned. And I realized how relatively deficient I was. So I was anxious to get back to school and, you know, catch up with the rest of these guys. Some of the guys, you know, made a career of it. But I chose to go back to school so I could, you know, prepare myself for greater things later on.
And your PhD is in?
It's DED, education.
How did your experience, has your experience in the war influenced your areas of interest?
Well, it certainly influenced my self-esteem. When I was able to get my wings and realize that 66% of the guys were eliminated, and I'm one of the, 34% that, you know, that got through flight school. Then that gave my ego a pretty big boost.
You had to be head and shoulders better than the next guy in a situation like that, where you're constantly under observation. You're you're being judged by standards that, you know, you're working against prejudice. So
yes. Mm-hmm.
The psychological pressure of that, was that something that ever got to you?
Well, you were on edge all the time because you knew the slightest misstep and you'd get the, you know, pink slip and that was sort of like, you know, bye-bye. So you're doing your best, the best you can, realizing that if you screw up anywhere along the way, you know, you're going to be out of here.
To understand the progress that we've made, I guess you really do need to have some sort of an experience of how rough things were. Could you tell us a couple of stories right now about some of the things that you had to deal with? Maybe not even just the really awful instances of racism and of hatred, but just the everyday banal rote indignities that you had to put up with.
Well, if you went any place off the base, you had to deal with all the, you know, racism. You have to ride in the back of the bus. They got signs, colored drinking water, white drinking water, colored
entrance.
Sure,
this is the Jim Crow South.
Yeah, this is the Jim Crow South, white entrances and that kind of thing. We had German prisoners of war on the base at Waldorf, South Carolina. And when those prisoners were taken in town on a work detail, they could go into any of the stores or restaurants and be served. We couldn't. In uniform during the time of war, but yet we couldn't have the privileges that our prisoners.
Were you ever tempted to let your cool get lost, as it were?
No, I don't recall the situation personally, but 101 of our officers were placed under house arrest because they wanted to use the officers' club. Now, they take due to ensure that the officers' clubs function, they take dues money out of your pay before you even get your check. Officers' dues are taken out of it. But this one commander at Freeman Field in Indiana did not want black officers in the officers' club. So he said, okay, look, you make up stuff. Well, you guys are trainees. They're officers now. Our flight surgeon.
Bars on the shoulders.
Our flight surgeon was a captain. But you guys are trainees, and trainees don't use this club. They threw the enlisted men out of their club and made that officers' club number two. That's where you trainees go. Well, our guy, you know, intelligent guys, they knew that was a lot of nonsense. So two or three or four at a time, they would go to the regular officers' club. And, of course, they had MPs at the door and all that kind of stuff. So the commander, the Colonel Selway, wrote a base regulation. Now, Army Regulation 100-10 says that all these facilities in the military should be open to all qualified personnel. But he writes his base regulation saying that I understand that since I'm a trainee, I shall use Officers Club Number 2. And he had the guys read it and told them to sign it, and they refused to sign it. So I said, okay, you guys are under house arrest.
What sort of reaction did you get from the white officers? Were they had guys who were sympathetic to you? Would you get served if you got into the OC? I mean,
well, there were some who were probably sympathetic. But then if you're outnumbered and if you're under the under the command of somebody who's totally against, you know, what you're trying to do, then, you know, you shy away from it. There were scads of white people that were sympathetic to the black man's cause, but they knew what they would suffer if they went along trying to support the black man. The Ku Klux Klan would just as readily whip and lynch you if you're, you know, supporting black people as they would the black guy that was, you know, that was trying to change things.
Sure.
I recall when I finished flight school, I was going home on leave. You know, oh man, I'm a proud 19 years old. I got wings. I got bars. Oh man, holler, dog. So I'm on the Pullman car going home, and they call, you know, announce it's dinner time. So we get in line to go into the dining hall, and I was back in line, five or six back in line. And the porter said, "Lieutenant, I can seat you right away." I said, "Oh man, wow, you know, privilege." He takes me in and as we sit to a particular table, and he pulls a curtain around me to segregate me from the rest of the people in the dining car. United States Army officer during the time of war, but yet the racism stuff is there. Well, you know, when the guys are ready to go into combat, when the 99th Squadron was fully formed, and they had, you know, all their combat training, you know, formation, flying, and gunnery, and dive, all that stuff, you know. None of the commanders in Europe would take the Black Squadron. Now, these guys were ready to go in, like, September of 1942.
I was going to ask you, did you have any, and I'm glad you bring this up, because there was some trouble at the beginning even getting into combat. Being able to fly combat operations,
yes,
and getting
being rated
combat ready,
yes,
et cetera. So you talk a little bit about that.
Yeah,
too.
Well, the guys were completely combat ready. They had they had 26 pilots. They're flying the P-40, which was a pretty good airplane for that that time of the war, and highly patriotic guys, anxious to prove themselves, anxious to prove that black men can fly and all that business. But none of the commanders in Europe would take a black squadron, neither in Europe nor in Japan. So the guys stay in the States for another 8 months. We're at war. We've been at war since December 8th, 1941. And now here it is the summer of 1942. And golly, you got all kinds of needs for manpower over there.
Yeah, we're almost a full year in. Operation Torch has already taken place. With the landing is there. We're in the fight.
Right, uh-huh. But we don't want these black guys over here. So it wasn't until May of 43 before the 99th Squadron got an assignment to go into combat in North Africa. And then even then, they were attached to the 33rd Group, where a guy named Momar was the commander. And he didn't want them, but they were assigned him, so he had to take them. And he billeted them on the far side of the field and, you know, ignored them as much as possible. Even instances where the briefing times were phonied up so that our guys would miss the briefing, you know. And that'd be another reason to, you know, negative marks. So they, he sent up these negative reports to the upper command, with the suggestion that they be disbanded and sent back to the States. And General Hap Arnold and others agreed with him. And our commander, Benjamin Davis, went to Washington to explain to a congressional committee how things were going. And General Eisenhower decided to review. He was commander of the Mediterranean Theater. He decided to review all the P-40 squadrons. And he found that Squadron 99 was doing just as well as the other squadron, so they're going to stay over here. Then he had Colonel Davis go back to the States and train three more squadrons, 100, 301, and 302. And those guys were known as the 332nd Group, but normally you have three squadrons in a group. So those three squadrons were the 332nd Group, and they go to Italy. They came over here in January of 44. And they operated out of Foggia. They landed in Taranto, down at the heel, and they were first stationed. The 99th was in Sicily. You know, the 332nd was never in Sicily, but they I mentioned Foggia, Ramitelli, some of those places. They were
flying missions all the way, because the advance was, it wasn't a static at that point. We were marching our way up the
peninsula. As you're moving up, they moved up. They were, one of the greatest things that happened was that in January of 44, the Allies invaded Italy through the port of Anzio, which is what I understand about 30 miles south of here.
Yep.
Our guys had the assignment of flying over our invasion fleet to protect them from German fighters. And in a week's time, our guys shot down 18. Now, prior to that, there had been one aerial combat victory back in July of 43. And the German fighters weren't down in North Africa, so they didn't come in contact with them. But yet they were scored by the number of combat victories they had. Well, I can't catch any whales in the desert. They're not there, But that's how they were scored. But at any rate, there weren't any more aerial victories until Anzio, which was about 6 months later. Let's see, July, about 6 months later. It's when our guys had shot down 18 in a week's time.
I wanted to sort of fast forward to the present. You look on the country as it is today. Are you happy with where we are, and where do we need to go?
Well, compared to how things were in the past, there's tremendous progress. From the point prior to the 60s, a lot of black people couldn't even vote. In the South, they had all these kind of poll taxes and voting tests and all that kind of nonsense. So here we are in 50 years later, and we have a black president who was elected by primarily white people. So there's been tremendous progress since from then until now. There's still a lot to be done, because some people say, well, my God, you got a black president, you should be satisfied. Well, that's one guy. But what about the masses of black people? How are they faring? How are they being treated? We have to look for the masses, and not just not just the one.
And because I was listening to something on the radio, they were talking about how the divide used to be between along racial lines for the achievement gap, and now it seems to be an economic one. That the difference is that the children of poor families and lower middle class families don't do as well as the children of wealthier families, and it sort of begged the question: what is the racial constitution of of the group of the poorest and the lower middle class? And is it disproportionately still made up of
people of color?
I'll be honest with you, I don't know the statistics on that, but it was something that I remember thinking to myself, and saying, that's the sort of thing that journalistically I would want to ask. It's a question that would come up, and it didn't. Uh-huh. And I'm wondering whether that isn't because we're not as race conscious as a society as we used to be.
Well, that's true. It's not as much overt racism, but we still have the economic business. We still have unions that resist black membership. And the reason that most of the poor people are black and the poorest education levels are black is because of the opportunities that they have or that they don't have. A kid in a middle class family has an advantage from the start. Take two families, a middle-class family and a poor family. From the time those kids come out of the womb, they have a different surrounding. What kinds of conversations go on in the very low-income house? What kinds of conversation go on in the middle-class house? What kind of thoughts and vocabularies are these two kids experiencing? So when they get into school, let's say the schools are equal. When they get into school, what does the poor kid bring with him to school as compared to what does the middle class bring with him to school? Do I have to teach this poor kid? I might have to teach him his colors. I might have to teach him how to count. I'll teach the alphabet.
Yeah, this was actually
but
a
this
point.
Middle class kid.
You get to first grade, and I remember this now that they talked about it. The regardless of race, the lower income student, when he gets to the first grade, if he grew up in a poor household, he's probably going to have an average vocabulary of between 5,000 and 10,000 words.
Uh-huh.
And the average vocabulary of the middle class and up is going to be twice that size. And when you come
much higher than that.
Mm-hmm. That's got to be significant.
Without question, it's significant for this kid progressing all the way through school, and why so many of the poor kids drop out of school because they're so darn far behind. And the chances are he's not in a school that's trying to compensate for his poor background. He's probably in a school that doesn't expect anything of him in the first place. So that poor background is just some weight around his neck.
Is it consternating to see that this, well, you know, we can't expect too much and we don't want to push people. Someone who has done the things that you've done, mm-hmm. against the odds against which you've done them, and understands what it means to work hard and harder than others to achieve what you have. Do we expect too little?
We do expect too little. Even though I grew up in the same social situation, that is the same racism and so forth, I was fortunate to be a member of a family where there was both a mother and a father present, and where they had high expectations. Just as my father was a minister, so they had high expectations for us. And the schools that fortunately, I went to school in Ohio that did not have state-sponsored school segregation. And so the schools had expectations. But some of these kids didn't have that, weren't advantaged to that degree. They didn't go to places where there were high expectations. They probably went to schools where, they're not going to learn anything anyway, so don't even bother, you know, that kind of thing. So those kids stay stuck. But the tragedy is that the kids that drop out of school are the kids that get involved in crime. They're the kids that are populating the prisons. And they're the kids that are not only holding the group down, but holding the country down. Whereas if we could see that little kid, even though he doesn't have shoes and he doesn't have some of these other physical things, he's got the same possible capabilities as any other kid. He just needs a chance for them to bloom, you know. He needs to be in an encouraging situation. And he needs to be in an enriching situation, and most of them are not. Tragically, in the States, I'm a retired school principal. I even helped get the teachers' union started, thinking that it was going to be a professional organization. But tragically, there's no other job where you take the most difficult work and give it to an apprentice and let the journeyman go and play fiddlesticks and get the higher pay. It doesn't happen anyplace else. But in education in the States, because of the unions, a teacher will use his or her seniority to be able to select what they want. And naturally, they pick the plums, you know.